want to say a few words to sort of introduce this new series of evenings, and then we'll have a cup of tea, and then I'll say a little bit more to start off with the first symbol. So yes, we're going to be looking at symbols from Tantric Buddhism, and particularly we're going to be referring to this book by Sangharakshita called Creative Symbols of Tantric Buddhism. And the book itself is based on a series of lectures that Sangharakshita gave in the 1970s, I think. In 72, so quite a number of years ago. We're not going to be looking at the whole book, and even the bits that we are going to look at, we're not going to be able to cover everything that's in the book. So I really would recommend looking out for this book. But I've just checked the bookshop, and unfortunately we don't have any copies in at the moment. I'll try and make sure that we get some copies in, assuming they're in print. I'll get some copies in for, if not next week, subsequent weeks. But yes, I want to just look at what we mean by Tantric Buddhism and what we mean by symbols, and I'm going to try and do that before tea in sort of a lightning fashion. To start off with Tantric Buddhism. Tantric Buddhism, also known as Vajrayana Buddhism, is the third of three great phases that Buddhism went through over the first 1500 years or so of Buddhism's sort of evolution. It went through three kind of great stages. Of course, they overlapped and intermingled, but broadly you can see these three great stages. The first stage, early Buddhism, it's sometimes called Hinayana Buddhism, but Hinayana can be a slightly pejorative term. So early Buddhism, as I'll call it, focused very much on ethical observances, but also on the psychology of the mind. All the sort of mind, the mental states that arise in our minds, and their ethical implication, their karmic implication. Then came this great phase called the Mahayana. And Mahayana Buddhism, broadly, and this is really to simplify things, developed a more metaphysical outlook and developed great sort of metaphysical positions, teachings about the nature of mind, about the nature of reality. And it also was a very devotional Buddhism. So many of the figures that you see sometimes us referring to at the LBC, like we've recently been talking about Avalokiteshvara. Those archetypal figures are from the Mahayana, mainly from the Mahayana tradition. So it was a Buddhism of faith and devotion on the one hand, and then highly developed metaphysical theories on the other. And then came this third phase, Vajrayana Buddhism or Tantric Buddhism, originating in India. And Vajrayana Buddhism sort of took the metaphysics of Mahayana Buddhism and kept it, but it particularly started to emphasize symbols rather than concepts. It started to particularly emphasize elaborate rituals and particular meditation practices that involved working with energy in the body. Vajrayana Buddhism was very, very concerned with direct experience. It was sort of saying, yes, all these conceptual frameworks of earlier, of Mahayana Buddhism, yes, okay, that was all fair enough, but enlightenment had to be realised here and now, in this very lifetime, or it didn't mean very much. So Vajrayana Buddhism was sort of, on the one hand, intensely practical and pragmatic, with an emphasis that you could become enlightened, anybody could become enlightened here and now. It was sort of very this-worldly. On the other hand, it had methods that were full of elaborate symbols and rituals and, well, tantric practices that we know of. And then Buddhism, of course, died out in India. So all of this originated in India. Buddhism died out in India, I don't know, around the 12th century for various reasons. I'm not a scholar, so I don't really know very much, but it died out for various reasons, including, I think the final straw was the sacking of various Buddhist monasteries by Islamic invaders. But there were other reasons as well to do with rivalry between what we know of today as Hinduism and Buddhism, various other things as well. Anyway, Buddhism died out in India, but by the time it died out in India, it had spread to other lands, and Vajrayana Buddhism was particularly taken up in Tibet. And so today, Tantric Buddhism primarily survives, as it were, at least in the East, in Tibet, and the Himalayan region around Tibet, so in northern India, Nepal, etc. Tantric Buddhism still survives. And of course then it's come over to the West. It's come over to the West particularly with the Chinese invasion of Tibet and the exodus that you had of Tibetan monks and nuns and, well, refugees into the rest of the world. And it spread to the West. And Sangharakshita he's I think a unique figure still in the contemporary Buddhist world. He's a unique figure in various ways, but one of them is that he sort of straddles all of those three great phases: Hinayana or early Buddhism, Mahayana, and then Vajrayana. So he was ordained as a monk in a school that belongs to early Buddhism, called the Theravadan school, still extant in Sri Lanka, Thailand, etc. So he was ordained as a Theravadan monk in India, but he also well, by temperament, he's a very, very, he's actually a very multifaceted man, but one of his facets is that he's a scholar, an incredibly widely read scholar, not just in terms of Buddhism, but just in terms of world literature. So he studied Buddhism from all of its branches, its roots and its branches. And he also had a teacher, at least one teacher from the Mahayana tradition, Chinese, from the Chinese Zen tradition, a master called Yogi Chen. And then he was based in northern India. He was living in northern India in Kalimpong when all these Tibetan refugees started to come through from Tibet into India, and consequently he encountered Tibetan Buddhism or Vajrayana Buddhism and had a number of teachers who were from the Vajrayana tradition. In fact, some of the main masters of Vajrayana in the 20th century passed through or lived in Kalimpong, and Sangharakshita Bhante was initiated into various Tibetan tantric meditation practices and rituals. So he's a figure that straddles those three branches of Buddhism. And he comes over to the West and decides that actually Buddhism needs a completely new expression in the West, in 20th century as it was, England. It needs a completely new expression. And in that new expression, he decides not to draw exclusively from any one of those branches, but to draw inspiration and teachings and practices from all of them. But not in an eclectic way. Sangharakshita was very clear about the principles that underlay all Buddhist schools and traditions. And his basic kind of premise, which Triratna follows, is that if you understand the principles, then you can draw inspiration and teachings and practices from these different schools and lineages. But they need to be reinterpreted in the light of those basic principles that go right way back to the earliest Buddhist teachings. And if you understand the principles, then you can practice Buddhism without needing to take on cultural forms that belong to a different country and time. So in order to draw inspiration from Tibetan Buddhism, you don't have to learn the language or become a Tibetophile or something. Yeah, that's part of at least Sangharakshita's vision, that the LDC and Triratna Buddhism generally is unfolding and trying to keep alive. So, the next couple of months or more, we're going to be looking at Tantric Buddhism. And we're going to be looking at it from just one tiny kind of window, which is to look at some of the symbols of Tantric Buddhism and how we might interpret them, how we might make use of them. That's kind of what we're going to be doing. So, just want to say a couple of things about a symbol, what a symbol is, and then we'll have a cup of tea. So, Sangharakshita differentiates between a symbol and a sign, and I'm just going to tell you what he says. So this is a symbol. Here you've got a symbol of the enlightened mind. A golden Buddha sitting on a lotus throne is a symbol. It's a symbol, obviously, because it's not, although it's got sort of historical references, it's not trying to depict a real human historical being. It's a symbol, it's an archetype. A symbol, as Sangharakshita defines it, is multivalent. What I mean by that is that there's no one meaning to it. It's rich in its connotations, it's rich in its references, it's rich in what it evokes. And it doesn't just map onto one conceptual idea. Yeah? If it did just map onto one conceptual idea, it would be a sign. A sign is like a road sign that says something like one way. You get an arrow on a road and it says one way. That's what it means. And there's only one thing that it means. And in a way it's just shorthand for a sentence or an idea. It's just a picture for an idea. That's a sign. Whereas a symbol can't be pinned down in that way. It doesn't mean just one thing. It's actually... in a certain sense, it's a living thing, because it has to become a symbol for you. If you take, a simple sort of Western image of a red rose. A red rose in Western culture is no longer just a red flower. It's got all sorts of symbols. It's got it's a symbol. It's got all sorts of connotations that come from a whole cultural tradition of songs and poetry and
Valentine's Day.
Valentine's Day and tacky cards and films. It's now completely imbued with that. If you were, I don't know, from, well, the Tibetan tradition, it probably wouldn't mean anything to you. You'd probably never seen a red rose if you'd never left Tibet. And even if you did, it wouldn't have those connotations. So a symbol has to be a symbol for each individual. Yeah? And an individual brings to it all the references and connotations from that cultural language that is shared. Or it might be quite personal. So I'm wearing a watch that belonged to my grandfather. And in a certain sense, this watch, which doesn't keep time very well, is like, for me, it's become a symbol. It's become a symbol of my ancestry, my heritage, etc., etc. So that's very personal. It probably wouldn't mean anything to, well, probably anybody outside my family. So sometimes symbols are intensely personal, and sometimes they're shared. Yeah. But either way, they're sort of alive because the connotations are constantly changing. Today, if you wrote a poem with a red, red rose in, it would have to be ironic. You couldn't go back to Elizabethan England and write the sonnet that Shakespeare wrote. You couldn't do it. We've moved on. So a symbol is constantly changing in its references. Do you see what I mean? It's alive. We bring it to life. And that's why Bhante talks about it as creative. It's a creative symbol. We imbue it with meaning, with life. And in that sense, we give it power. We give it power over our responses. So I'm going to probably carry on saying a little bit more after tea about symbols, and then I want to move on to the first of the symbols and images that we want to explore. So let's have tea now. So, yes, in front of you or in your hands, you've got an image of a symbol called the Tibetan Wheel of Life. You've probably heard of it, even if you haven't seen it, and some of you will have seen them. I'm going to ask you just for a moment to not look at it and look at me instead. Because before we look at it, I just want to explore one or two things more about the nature of symbols. I thought it might just be worth seeing. That's all right, don't worry. Worth sort of asking, why are symbols important? Oh, and by the way, it wasn't Shakespeare, was it? It was Burns. And it's not a sonnet. Anyway. And now that's recorded and will be forever on Free Buddhist Audio before. But anyway, never. It wasn't. Yes. Anyway, let's move on. You have to look at principles, not literal. So, why are symbols important? Why do you think symbols are important, or useful, or important, particularly to the spiritual life, but to life in general, actually? What role do they play?
I think that sometimes language doesn't... It can't describe everything, so you need something that sort of points you in the direction without trying to describe something very precisely.
Yeah. Can you think of an example? I think you're right, that language doesn't always...
I think everything.
Everything. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
But when we speak about divine concepts in particular, I think people get very tangled up in trying to find the logical structure of it.
Yes.
When it might be easier just to sort of go, it's a bit like that, and stop trying to...
Yes.
To pin it down.
Yes. Yes, it's like, in a certain sense, everything evades precise definition by language. no experience can be fully captured by language. No experience, even a simple experience like, I don't know, cleaning your teeth. No amount of words can convey what that's like. Just that simple everyday experience. No amount of articulation will be able to capture that experience completely. In fact, Sangharakshita goes further and says words themselves are symbols because they're metaphors. Words, after all, are trying to point beyond themselves. Words aren't the thing itself. Words are pointers to some experience beyond the words. So in that sense, they're symbols, they're metaphors. And most words have more than one meaning to them, depending on context, depending on intonation, depending on who's saying them. Words have more than one, they're multivalent. And I guess poetry uses that multivalency at its most developed, at its height, and plays with metaphor and ambiguity in order to point beyond the words. And it does that in a very self-aware way, so that it uses words in a knowing that words are metaphors. So potentially everything is a metaphor or a symbol that can't be captured by words. But then you said, yes, particularly when you're talking about, as it were, divine experiences, experiences that seem to go beyond our ordinary notion of me and, me and other, language starts to run out. It runs out quite quickly. It's all right for catching the number 8 bus home, even though you know that the number 8 bus is actually a symbol or a metaphor or a pointer to some big red thing. It sort of is adequate. But when you start talking about enlightenment or transcendent experience or being more aware of meaning, even when you start talking about just the human condition, the fact that we're mortal and that we're here for a finite length of time, and start looking at what life is, words start to be more and more inadequate to that. It's more, well, symbols, poetry can reach more depth than ordinary prose, prosaic words can. So yes, that's one, in a way, key reason, I think, why symbols are so important. But there are others. Can anybody think of anything else as to why symbols are valuable, important? Yeah.
Maybe because it's universal, it's not linked to language, so it kind of breaks the linguistic barrier.
Yes, it sort of goes beyond language and starts to become universal. At least some symbols do. Some symbols do. And in that sense, maybe they start to become a unifying force for shared experience. So Jung talks about the collective unconscious, and he, not that I know much about Jung, would probably have said that, you know, certain symbols are universal and all human beings participate in them because they speak to us at a sort of they go beyond conscious thinking into the depths of the subconscious. They're primary somehow. So yes, because they go beyond language, there's the potential for them to be universal. Not all symbols will be universal, but there's a potential for them to be that. I think that hints at another thing, but go on, yes.
Well, they're always from the physical world, aren't they?
Yes.
They represent something spiritual and ideas.
Yes. I think that's a really important point, and Tantric Buddhism particularly emphasizes this. So what Tantric Buddhism says is that you take something from the physical material world, like a lotus flower, and you use it to point to something transcendent that goes beyond the material world. So in Buddhism, a lotus flower has come to mean many, many things. It's come to mean our unfolding spiritual potential. It's come to mean purity. It's come to, you know, innate purity, the purity of the enlightened mind that is also our innate purity. It's come to symbolize that purity in a particular way, because the lotus grows in mud. So it starts off in this mud, and yet by the time it flowers, the petals are completely unstained. They're completely unstained. Even water rolls off them. So it's the purity from the mud, which then starts to symbolize not just human potential, but the human condition. The Buddha is said to have, after his enlightenment, looked around, as it were, in his imaginative, in his imagination, with the enlightened perspective. And what he saw was humanity as a great bed of lotuses, with different flowers in different stages of growth and unfoldment. And of course then that becomes a symbol for something that really unites us, and yet allows for spiritual development. So that's an example of a concrete, as it were, tangible, material thing being used to point to something that transcends all material things. And what Tantric Buddhism starts to do is it imbues everyday reality, more and more of everyday reality, with symbolic significance. So colour is a very, very important tool in Tantric Buddhism. Colour is given precise, meaningful symbolic significance. So, for example, a red Buddha is associated with compassion and love, metta at its highest. But then, what Tantric Buddhism would say is that every time you encounter the colour red, it should remind you of metta at its highest. So you then start to, if you were living like that, start to associate everyday experience with the ideal, with enlightened mind, with your goal. And then that becomes a very powerful way of living. Yeah, that becomes a very, very powerful way of living. You imbue more and more of your life with ritual symbolic significance. Not in a melodramatic way, in a very down-to-earth way, but you would be reminded of what your ultimate purpose is in life. And we need to be reminded, because we get lost, we keep getting lost, we keep forgetting. So symbols can be really useful as reminders, because they come from the material world and they're pointing to something transcendent. Yeah. Another thing that, well, maybe one last thing that comes to my mind anyway, is that symbols can touch us more deeply than concepts can. Just in the way that poetry can touch us more deeply than prose can, at least at its best. Symbols speak to a deeper part of consciousness. They speak almost directly, or they can do, if you let them, they can speak more directly to inchoate emotions that we may not even be fully conscious of. And yet those emotions often shape our lives and our experience. We like to think that we're really rational beings, We like to think that we're in control of our decisions, and actually we're not. And I think modern psychology and even neuroscience is recognising this. It's saying that we're not governed by rational decision-making. Most of what drives us is below that rational surface. Symbols start to touch that and talk to that deeper instinct, those instinctive drives. And those deeper emotions and volitions need to be harnessed if we're really going to change. Yeah? All of us know that mindfulness and metta and Buddhist ethics are a good idea. Probably by this stage, all of us would sort of say, yeah, it'd be better to be aware, it'd be better to be kind, it'd be better to be generous than not. And yet, that knowledge, that assent, seldom is enough to actually change our lives, change us. So symbols and ritual use of those symbols start to help change us at a deeper level. At a deeper level, they engage us. If you let them. You don't have to let them. You can be completely closed to them if you choose to. And if you are close to them, they can't touch you. They won't touch you. You have to decide to be open to whatever a symbol says to you. You have to let it speak. You have to listen. You have to be receptive. So it's very appropriate that we're looking at this material in this year of Dharmic receptivity. You have to learn to be receptive to symbols. Shall we move on? So, yeah, Ethan.
What is incorrect?
Sort of unformulated, undefined. What does incorrect mean? It's not even described yet to oneself. It's inarticulate, which is what I'm getting at. Thanks. Thanks for asking. Good. So let's look at this image. Now, the first thing to say about the Tibetan Wheel of Life is that Sangharakshita points out that it's not completely, truly a symbol. It's partly a symbol, and it's partly a sign. It's a mixture of the two, so it's actually quite a good place to start off with. The reason that it's partly a symbol is that some aspects of this image do have a sort of multivalent resonance, but then some aspects of it are just pictorial descriptions, pictorial pointers to concepts, and there's a one-to-one matching. You can sort of say, yes, this picture means this. And so it's partly a symbol, partly a sign. It's a mixture of the two. And we're going to be exploring it over the next 4 weeks. So tonight I'm just going to sort of introduce it and say a few general things. Maybe we'll look at a couple of things more detailed. And then we're going to explore particular aspects over it over the following 3 weeks. So try and bring your Wheel of Life. You can colour it in. I know you want to. So you can colour it in as a week go on. So when you look at the Wheel of Life, I should say that it's called a Tibetan Wheel of Life, but actually it originates in Indian Buddhism. But it survives mainly in Tibetan Buddhism. And in Tibetan temples, you often find it outside the shrine room, sometimes on the door or the wall outside the shrine room. You don't find them in the shrine room. You find them outside the shrine room. And that's because the Wheel of Life is not talking about the ideal. It's not talking about the enlightened mind. Primarily, at least. Primarily what it's talking about is unenlightened mind. It's talking about mundane existence, conditioned existence for unenlightened individuals like me and you. Okay. So it's therefore not something to worship as an ideal. It's actually a rather salutary reminder of what the unenlightened experience can be like. It's rather a sobering reminder of what the unenlightened experience can be like. And Bhante says that you could see it as a mirror. When you look at the wheel of life, poetically, you're looking in a mirror. And this is what the human condition is from a dharmic perspective. It's almost like the enlightened mind is saying this is what unenlightened existence is like. So it's the enlightened perspective on unenlightened existence. Yeah? So in a certain sense you're looking in a mirror. And looking in a mirror is useful if you can face the truth. If you can't, then it becomes actually a bit too frightening. It becomes too frightening. At least looking into the Tibetan Wheel of Life can become a bit too frightening. So it needs to come with a bit of a health warning. It needs to come with a health warning that you need to look at the images in this Wheel of Life with metta in your heart, and with a sense of shraddha, that enlightenment is possible, that spiritual growth is possible, that you are on a path of spiritual development. That there is a way out, as it were, from this rather frightening image that we're going to explore. There isn't just mundane existence, there's more to us. Yeah? So that's a sort of health warning to the Tibetan Wheel of Life before we look into the mirror. And Bhante says you need to look at it, at least four times, because there's four concentric circles, and each of them is like a mirror, looking at your own mind, our own mind, at least four times, probably more than four. So it's this wheel consisting of concentric circles, which we'll start to look at, and then the whole thing, the wheel, is held by a demon. This huge fanged demon with skulls on his crown and great big claws. Does anybody know what that demon symbolizes?
Death.
Yeah, it is. It's more generally, it's impermanence. It's the fact that there is nothing permanent, that nothing lasts, that there's nothing that you can hold on to that will stay the same. And death is, in a way, the paradigm of that. So yes, it's the demon of impermanence who holds the wheel of life. So already you're into deeper existential waters. It's saying that everything in mundane existence, everything in mundane existence, in conditioned existence, is ephemeral. Everything will come into being, and because it's coming into being, it will also pass away. And of course that includes us, it includes all life. And then this wheel of life particularly looks at life itself. It's less concerned about non-animate stuff in the universe. It's looking at life. It's looking actually at mind as well as life. So yeah, you've got these four concentric circles, this wheel, this demon of impermanence, and then in the two corners, what do you see in the two corners, the upper left-hand and right-hand corners?
A rabbit,
yeah. It's a hare. It's a hare in the moon. And then on the other corner, you've got a Buddha figure, sort of pointing to impermanence. And the Buddha figure in that corner anyway, in a way is pointing to a way out from this round of impermanence. He's pointing to a way out of the wheel. So he's pointing to the possibility of enlightenment, of nirvana. That's what the Buddha figure is there for. And the hare is a symbol for the bodhisattva. The bodhisattva is enlightenment working in space and time. And the hare refers to a sort of mythical life story called a Jataka tale, which is like a previous life of the Buddha. In one of his previous lives, he's said to have been born as a hare before his enlightenment, before the human birth. He was born into many animal forms, it's said, in the sort of myths of Buddhism. And one of those lives, he was born as a hare, and he sacrificed himself because there was... do you remember what it was? A starving tigress. I don't know if it was. It might be. But anyway, there's some starving animal, I'll look up in a minute, call it tigress, and the hare, out of compassion, sacrifices himself. And of course, the animal, the tigress, or whatever it was, turns out to be Indra, the chief of the gods, and he restores the hare to eternal life in the moon. In Tibetan Buddhism, you don't see a man in the moon, you see a hare in the moon. And the hare in the moon, next time have a look, if you can. The hare in the moon symbolises the bodhisattva working towards alleviating suffering for all sentient beings. So those two corner images, I wanted to point them out because they're the positive alternative, and you need to remember there is a positive alternative, because the rest of the wheel ain't so positive. It's not so happy, at least most of it. So how are we doing for time? Yes, so let's just look at the innermost of those concentric circles, the centre of the wheel, which in a way is the hub, the heart, and the first mirror that you encounter when you look at it. So what do you see? I don't know if you can make it out in your image. Mm-hmm. What do you see in that innermost circle?
A pig, a cockerel, and a serpent.
A pig, a cockerel, and a serpent. Thank you. A pig, a cockerel, and a serpent. Some of you who have just been to Vajrasana, I know at least one of you, there's a cockerel, actually there are two at Vajrasana. Nothing to do with the Wheel of Life, but they're a real pain. They look beautiful, and they're not great to have around. At least the cockerels at Vajrasana, and I believe there's only one now, because the other one's probably been got by a fox.
There's one and a half.
One and a half, that's not nice. But their alarm clock is all over the place, and at 2 in the morning they start and then they carry on throughout the night. Anyway, that's an aside. A cockerel, a pig, and a serpent, and each of them is sort of biting the other one, forming this sort of triangle, this sort of circular triangle, I guess, biting each other. So there's a round. And this cockerel, this pig, and this serpent, this snake, are said to be not just at the heart of the wheel, at the hub of the wheel, but they're said to drive all of conditioned existence, because they're at the heart of the unenlightened mind. They're in the very depths of our own mind. And what they symbolise, each of the animals symbolises what's called a poison, a root poison. So the serpent symbolises hatred in the human heart, all the forces of aversion, of anger, of resentment, of pushing away, of hatred, of rejecting. The serpent symbolises that force within the human mind. The cockerel symbolises greed and all the craving, all the lust, all the unsatisfied desire of the human heart and human mind. And what do you think the pig is? What do you think the pig symbolises?
Delusion,
of course. So the pig is the underlying delusion out of which, in a way, greed and hatred stem. But in the Wheel of Life, they all are biting each other, so it's like there's no first cause. There's just greed and hatred and delusion, and they're just... They're interlinked. You can't have one without the other, if you like. Or as soon as you've got one, you've got the other two, unfortunately. They're interlinked in that way. They're driving the wheel, and they're going round and round. And the whole wheel spins because of that round. So let me just ask you, does that seem a fair assessment of the human heart and mind? Does that feel fair? That was a resounding yes from one quarter. What do you think? Let's just see how many people, just show your hands, think this is a fair assessment of the human heart and mind? Okay, and how many don't think it is fair?
As a totality, as all consuming.
As the centre of it. So, roughly even, and then who doesn't have an opinion? Yeah, fair number. Fair number, okay. So actually we're fairly evenly split between those who think it is, those who don't. So let's hear from... at least from those who do and those who don't. So, just be nice to hear from one or two people who think it is a fair assessment. What makes you think it's a fair assessment?
I can be brutally honest, actually. I work in, let's say, business development.
Yeah.
And it's...
businesses
as a salesperson.
Yeah, great.
And so, basically, I look at that and the greed, and it's really funny because I basically work for a company that's gone from 20 million turnover to 5 million in a year. The company's been brought to its knees, and I honestly think one of the things that's brought it to its knees is greed and karma, because the owner of the company has lied to various people about their earnings to get them in, and then they stay, and then they're not as motivated. Mm. So you can see greed and karma run the company. He's getting his karma.
Yeah.
Greed is embedded within the culture of the company.
Yeah.
Delusion of people like me that join the company thinking they'll be earning what they're told.
Right.
But then you learn a lesson about actually... well, what is life really about? Money and everything. So that's a very valuable lesson I've learned.
Yeah.
Including having lost a partner through it because I got distracted with work.
Oh.
So I'll never get him back.
Yeah.
And then what was the snake? Hatred.
Yeah.
And you go through that cycle of really disliking the people you blame potentially for having lost a partner, and then you actually go. Well, I actually looked at that and laughed because I thought, oh, that's just basically the interconnected annoyance of life. But then was able to look at that and go, but I've learned a lesson through all of that. Realised they have driven me at some point. Those have been weaknesses, and now I'm coming out of that and are taking a step back and going, actually, what's really important in life?
Loads
of other stuff.
Yeah. Oh, look, thank you very much. Thank you for being so honest and just so articulate about relating your experience to this image. Thank you. Yeah. Anybody else who does think it is a fair... Yeah.
I can see beyond the delusion of the pig. So this is the centre of the unenlightened mind.
Yes.
Yeah. Delusion about the three marks.
Yes.
Impermanence, really experiencing impermanence.
Yes.
And dukkha.
Yes, unsatisfactoriness.
So from that stems unenlightened mind.
Yes, it does. Yes, from that stems unenlightened mind.
So I can see that.
Yeah. I guess what, from a Buddha's perspective, it would be that we, or unenlightened beings, are just going round and round in the sort of ignorance that we associate sometimes with animals, that we might associate with animals. From a Buddha's perspective, we probably look like, you know, lost, deluded animals that cause ourselves unnecessary suffering and hurt others in the process. Yeah. But anybody disagree? I mean, anybody think that, hang on, this isn't quite, this can't be right? Dominic, yes.
I think if you think about the opposites, greed would be kind of generosity,
yep.
Hatred would be love,
yep.
Delusion would be wisdom or yep. Insight. To think that these are the only things driving the wheel seems yep. Like out of balance.
Yeah, it feels out of balance. Yeah, yeah. So I guess what you're saying is that the human experience, the human heart and the mind is also capable of those other positive things of love and generosity and awareness and wisdom. And I think you're right, that actually from a certain perspective, and Tibetan Buddhism has this as a teaching, you could say that at the very, very core of the human mind, the heart of the human mind, there's a potential for Buddhahood. And all the qualities of Buddhahood are innate within us, at least in germinal potential form. They may not have flowered into fully open lotuses, but yes, they're there. And in human beings, they find expression. They find expression. So I think that's also true. Anybody else want to say anything about why it isn't?
Why isn't it? I think what struck me a few years ago is how the cycle gets replicated at different levels of experience and in the universe. I think I come more from kind of an activist background, so I
yes.
spent a lot of energy fighting greed, delusion, hatred in the world.
Yes.
And I think upon starting to practice Buddhism, there's just this mirroring image. You realize the same forces in your own mind.
Yes.
Yes. You need to work on both
yes.
if you want to make any kind of progress.
Yes.
I mean, there's something about making that connection that what's happening in here, it's what's out there. And
yes.
It's reflective. That was really important somehow. And that, for me, is the connection between kind of action out there in the world.
Yes.
And action on my own mind. Is
yes.
That it's the same
yes.
forces, just on different levels.
Yes. Yes. And Buddhism generally, Sangharakshita particularly perhaps, is very, very clear that if we're going to practice the Dharma life, we need to be working both internally on our own mind to purify it of these forces of greed and hatred and delusion, and we need to be trying to transform the world. And one without the other isn't enough. To just be transforming the world, or trying to, without working on the greed and hatred and delusion in our own mind, we end up actually just adding to the problem. Even though short term we might think we're making a positive difference, in the long term we're just adding to the problem, because we're not, acting out of righteous indignation, for example, won't in the long term lead to the peace, the equality, the contentment that we're working towards. Similarly, if we're just working on our own minds without any concern for suffering in the world, other people and general material suffering in the world, then you can end up with a sort of refined selfishness. So you might become sort of happier and more positive as a result of meditation and generally working on your ethics, etc. But if that doesn't then find expression in terms of helping others, well, it just becomes a complacent selfishness, albeit more refined than before you started meditating. So that can't be enough. Besides, there is real suffering in the world, and it's no good just doing the metta bhavana on your cushion if we're not going to then take it out into the world. What is the point? What is the point? So you need to be doing both. And so yes, greed, hatred and delusion need to be tackled, as it were, internally and externally. In whatever ways we can. But, sorry, yeah, go on, Michael.
Not to make
yeah.
about the Tibetan stuff, I find a bit sort of, I don't always warm to it, but the main thing I get from this is that they're all grabbing onto something else.
Mm.
And the reason why I sometimes find Tibetan stuff or Mahayana stuff a little bit, don't always warm to it, it can be very complex. Whereas my understanding is that the thing that you never want to forget is it's the grasping.
Yeah.
The grasping, that's the kind of, that's the real problem, I suppose.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So that, when I look at that, that's, without getting, it only can seem like a really negative image, obviously it's people raising.
Yeah.
But that grasping part of it is just really, you can't get that.
You can't avoid that.
Yeah.
And it's also, they're grasping each other and they're feeding on each other.
Yeah.
It's horrible. But that's what happens. Yeah. These three poisons feed on each other.
Mm-hmm.
They augment each other, they grow.
Mm.
Yeah, good point. Yes, Brian.
I think we can all look at ourselves or other people and say, okay, so it's pretty easy to see this wheel happening for other people, especially if they're difficult towards us.
Sure, yes. That's
why
it's not the name of them.
Why are they acting like that?
Yeah.
And then when you bring this to mind, then you can see, oh, okay, that person. Often people are incredibly difficult, but don't quite feel I think they are. And because they're difficult, the response they get back is a difficult response.
Sure.
Which, and then they think, well, why is this person being horrible to them?
That's right.
Even though they're created, it's pretty obvious they can see that they're creating themselves by doing something terrible. But it's and then if they get that they did that thing terrible, it caused the problem in the first place.
Yeah.
And then you can see, well, that is the delusion.
Yeah.
You don't realise that. And then that creates hatred for them because they believe that they're being unjustly treated. And then they're more likely to do it and more likely. So, when you see that will, you can. And but the interesting thing for me is that, and I think, well, how does that, how does that? What am I doing in my life to cause things that are happening to me? Am I deluded?
Yeah.
So this thing is something like any information you get, you can see something and then find ways that it fits into society and life.
Yeah.
Say, this is true, but I don't think that's the whole. That doesn't necessarily mean it's the whole truth, does it? Because
no.
Also, if you had another wheel, then I could look at it and say, okay, so-and-so, I know some friends who are very happy married and have got great kids and they're very... And you can see a positive spiral for them happening as well, even though they're not Buddhist. So,
yeah.
And they are genuinely nice people. And that creates a goodwill and that creates good positive feedback. So there are other wheels happening at the same time, but you can't focus on this is it, because if you think it's it, you'll find it.
Well, yes and no. I'd say yes and no. I think that's right. Yes, in the sense that I think that greed and hatred and delusion aren't the only forces at work in the human heart and mind, and nor are they the only forces at work in the world. And yet, from an enlightened being's perspective, even our kind of positive actions, even our generous actions, etc., are still within conditioned existence. They're still within conditioned existence as long as there's a sense that we exist as a separate, fixed and separate self. So somehow this wheel of life is pointing not just at unskillful behaviour, although it does include that. It also, as we look at it a bit more closely over the next couple of weeks, we'll see that it includes skillful behaviour, at least unenlightened skillful behaviour. It includes that as well, which is a bit sobering. But I'll maybe say a little bit more about that next week. That's not to say that Buddhism doesn't put a huge amount of importance on acting skillfully. Of course it does. But even skillful behaviour isn't enough to get us off this wheel. That's interesting, isn't it? because it's still even skillful behaviour, unless it's rooted in the wisdom of the enlightened mind, is still rooted in delusion. But you might have to park that. I will come on to that next week. But yes, at your own level, you're right that greed and hatred and delusion, it doesn't do justice to the human experience to say that's all there is. Otherwise, if that was all there is, enlightenment wouldn't be possible.
It's a bit cliche now, isn't it, to mention the Mandela quote in saying that he could see the humanity and the kind and the goodness in anybody, doesn't matter how
horrible they are.
There's always something you could see.
Yeah.
There are other things.
And I think that is a really valid way of looking, particularly at other people. So it's a very Tibetan, standard Tibetan way of looking at it, is when you are dealing with other people, particularly, as you say, difficult people, you try and see them as your teachers, as parents of yours who have loved you in a previous life, have reared you. You even try and see them as potential Buddhas. Yeah? When you look at yourself, you apply a different criteria because you want to wake up to enlightenment, you want to become enlightened, and you have to then be a bit more self-critical. That's the Tibetan approach, the Bodhisattva approach, it's not just the Tibetan approach. Other people you try and see as potential Buddhas, and you forgive them all their faults, you see them as your teachers, even their irritating, annoying habits are just giving you opportunities to learn patience. Isn't that wonderful? There, you're surrounded by gifts where you can learn patience. But you yourself, you look at your own heart and mind and you see your own greed and hatred and delusion. Now that requires a lot of positivity. Yeah? So you do require self-metta. And you do require a belief in your own potential to transcend that and become a Buddha yourself. So that's why when we approach this wheel, we have to have all sorts of caveats. Yeah? We are potential Buddhas, we can transcend ourselves, and yet, in order to do that, we really have to start looking honestly at where we are. And this wheel is trying to hold a mirror up to say, look, this is the unenlightened mind, this is where you are. If you can really acknowledge that, you can start to do something about it. Of course, it's not all of you, but this is what keeps you unenlightened. And what's more, they're animals. I'll come back to you, Savanta. They're animals. And Bhante makes the point that that's not just a nice sort of symbol. They're animals because we are, at least in part, animals in our nature, in our biological nature, and in parts of our primitive brain. There is still a reptilian brain somewhere, and we are, if we're not very self-aware, we're driven by the same instincts, often, as animals are. We do it in more sophisticated ways. So I think it is quite significant that these forces of the human psyche are depicted as animals. It's not very flattering, of course, but that's what they are. I've got a question here, and then if I've got time, I'll come to you. Yeah.
I just wanted to say, I mean, people looking at this, they maybe look at it and on a flat plane.
Uh-huh.
I don't look at it that way. I look in a three-dimensional way.
Ah.
And for me, that's as bad as it gets. You know, when you go right to the bottom, you're right down in the lowest point.
Yeah.
So, of course, there are other levels. You can be happier on a different level.
Yeah.
But this is as bad as it gets.
It's as bad as it gets. That's interesting. When we look at some other aspects of the wheel, you'll certainly see that it's not all on one level. And actually, there are more positive states. There are also very dark states on this image. And next week I'm going to be exploring heavenly states and then also hellish states. So next week you can look forward to heaven and hell. I'll take requests as to which I do first. But that's what we'll look at next week. Maybe I'll just take one more. Do you want to?
Yeah. It's just that I didn't really have an opinion on this, but now I do agree with it, because I think in a sense, okay, you can take it as sort of delusion, greed and hatred, in a sense that, in a sort of negative sense, but then at the same time, you could be sort of generating, as you said, like you could be generating good things out of it, good things, but then it's still based on this, so it's like sort of on a human kind of a level, you can be generating good and bad out of these things. And,
Yeah. I think that's right. And I think it's just, I mean, I'll just finish on this note, in a way reiterating something. That in Buddhism, Buddhism doesn't favour guilt. It doesn't say that you're therefore a bad, bad person because these forces are operating in you. Yeah? It doesn't condemn any human being in that absolute way. What it says is, look, if you can recognise that these forces are part of who you are, what drives you, then you've got more of a chance of transforming them. And you have got the potential to transform them. That's what the Buddha is pointing to, that potential for transformation. That potential is also part of the human condition. And Buddhism is just saying, all human beings have that potential for transformation, but the Buddha and his teachings are a very intelligent way of making that transformation happen. Yeah, a very systematic, intelligent, articulated way of spiritual development, of growth. All human beings have that capacity and capability. Not all human beings realise it. Buddhism gives you some tools in order to realise it. So it's a very kind of, you could think of it as a very positive thing to really be honest with ourselves, so that we can move forward, not so that we can start to just wallow in guilt. That's just unhelpful. Yeah. So take that positive thing, and let's come back next week. Bring your image with you. Colour it in if it helps. Actually, it probably will. It'll help you focus a little bit more on the symbolism. And next week we'll look at heaven and hell. Thank you.